From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, this hour we welcome Monroe County District Attorney Sandra Dorley back to the program. The district attorney is running for re-election, and here on Connections, we seek to sit down with all candidates for prominent federal, state, and local offices. Earlier this month, we welcomed the challenger in this contest, Democrat Shani Curry Mitchell. Today, it's our chance to hear from the incumbent. Sandra Dorley has worked in the DA's office since 1992, rising in the ranks to become first assistant DA under her predecessor, Mike Green. In 2011, she was elected to be the first female district attorney in Monroe County. This would be her third term. And 4 years ago, Democrats really only ran a placeholder against Dorley. This time around, there's an active challenge, and Dorley has said she welcomes that. She wants active debate and a chance to compare records, and this is our chance to do that with her. So welcome back to the program, Monroe County District Attorney Sandra Dorley. Thanks for being here.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I said to the district attorney before the hour began that I wasn't planning on bringing this up, but she kind of convinced me that I should, because listeners may be wondering how you're doing, how your health is.
Sure.
We know that several years ago, in fact, she knows the date.
I do.
Probably down to the hour.
Probably I do.
you were diagnosed in 2016 with cancer, and tell us how you're doing then.
Sure. And it was April 20th of 2016. I was diagnosed with multiple myeloma. I thought I had injured my back in the gym because I was working out regularly. And it was actually my chiropractor who sent me to get an X-ray, then an MRI and a CT scan. And he was the one who diagnosed me. And for, you know, a couple of months, it was, you know, pretty ugly, as it is with anyone going through, you know, cancer. It's life changing. One day you're, you know, living your life, and the next day you had this obstacle. But, you know, I pushed through. By August of 2016, I was in remission. And then in October of 2016, I had a stem cell transplant, which was an amazing thing. And since then, I have been in remission. I have more energy than I think I ever have. I've changed some of my lifestyle ways, but I'm as good as new.
And the reason I say that I wasn't even really going to ask is because we're obviously aware of the diagnosis. It was well publicized, but I haven't thought about you sort of in that context in a while now, which is, I suspect, what you want. But I know you also said this is something that you're proud of.
Exactly. And you know what? I don't talk about it, but it is a part of me. And when I'm out in the community, people do come up and ask me. They say, you know, how are you feeling? And I, you know, I'm not ashamed of it. I'm not embarrassed. It's something that I went through. It's a part of me. I think it's made me a better person. And I hope that if there's someone out there who is listening, or someone out there who, you know, has a similar diagnosis, that maybe I can be an inspiration to them, because cancer is not a death sentence anymore. We have wonderful doctors, especially in this area, wonderful treatments. And many people are living, you know, their best lives after cancer. So I hope I can be an inspiration.
So you're running for re-election. Did you give any thought to not running?
You know, I did, but I still think that I have a lot of good to do yet in the office. And the office has become a family to me. I've been there. This is my 27th year, and I love the people I work with. I love what we are committed to doing, and I love the fact that we can bring justice to the community.
A lot has changed in 27 years in that,
oh my God,
you know,
yes.
27 years ago, I'm not sure what was going on in the way of opioids and heroin, you know, which we'll talk about this hour, I think.
Exactly.
What are the biggest changes you've seen in the course of your career?
Oh my goodness, technology. I mean, that first and foremost, when I started in the DA's office, we had typewriters. And really, I'm not that old, I swear. And you know, maybe our secretaries had computers. We had answering machines, you know, with your cassette tapes. And I mean, things have progressed so much. When I was doing the bulk of my trial work, my felony trial work, I didn't have to deal with all of the nuances that my ADAs are dealing with now. For example, anywhere you go, there's a camera. There are blue light cameras in the city. Most residents and businesses have cameras. There are, you know, many, many things that we can gain from cell phone technology, and that wasn't around when I was doing the bulk of my cases. So we've gone from, you know, you put a witness on who's seen a crime and they'll say what they saw, to now we can probably prove a crime technologically without, you know, a live witness. It's amazing to think of.
But it's sound technology, it's reliable technology.
It is, because before we're able to put forth that technology in a courtroom, we have to have, or someone has to have had, a Frey hearing, a hearing to determine whether or not it is acceptable in, you know, the scientific community, if it's a scientific advancement, or if it is good evidence. So we were able to do that.
One other change since 1992, when you started your career here in Monroe County in the DA's office, is, you know, maybe close to a decade into your career, all the CSI shows were so popular. And then everybody thinks everybody should be able to snap your fingers and have perfect DNA for this and that. And sort of the interplay in the courtroom of whether it's prosecutors or defense trying to kind of leverage what the jury may know or not know, or maybe only know from TV dramas, which is interesting.
Exactly.
How much has that impacted the work?
You know, it has. And I think juries expect to see all of that forensic, that CSI evidence. And if we have it, we put it on. But in some cases, we don't. And that's something that, you know, our attorneys and I in particular would voir dire meaning, you know, questioning of a jury. I would say, look, you may think that this is like TV. You may think that we could get DNA off of this, but we can't, and we're not going to have it in this case. Would that affect your ability to be fair and impartial?
Monroe County District Attorney Sandra Dorley is our guest for the hour, and when she ran for re-election 4 years ago, you really didn't have an opponent. I mean, there was someone on the ballot. It was essentially a placeholder. You told Gary Craig of the Democrat and Chronicle before that election that, you know, you seemed a little disappointed in that, that you don't mind a comparison of the records, and you think that a vigorous debate's a good thing, yeah?
I do. And one of the things I like about campaigning, I like going out in the community, and I like to talk about the office, because a lot of people don't really know what we do in the DA's office. They may think one thing. They don't know the magnitude of the cases that we handle, the number of attorneys that are in the office, and what we do and what we don't do. So I really like, you know, the education part and talking about the office and all the good things that we're doing.
What do you think people mistake most often about your work?
You know, they think that all we do is put people in jail. You know, but we don't. We don't. We have so many diversion programs in Monroe County in particular, and I have not, you know, verified this, but I would say that if you looked around New York State, we have more diversion courts and more diversion programs available in Monroe County than any other place in the state. And it's nice to tell people that, you know what, we're making sure, you know, for public safety that, you know, bad individuals are held accountable and aren't a risk of public safety, but we also want to protect victims, and we also want to protect those who may come into the criminal justice system for the first time and give them a way out and a way to help their lives.
Listeners, if you want to join the program with questions maybe about how the office works under the district attorney, Sandra Dorley, who's running for re-election, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Now, the district attorney knows her challenger pretty well, Shani Currie Mitchell, and when she was on the program, I think, you know, what she said she'd prefer to do, and I suspect a lot of candidates prefer this, is to talk more about their own vision, which is fine, and I suspect you feel the same way. But I also did hear her kind of draw some distinctions, or at least raise some of her concerns about why she's running. And to be fair, I just want to play one clip and give you a chance to hear that.
Certainly.
And then we can kind of talk about this. So in this case, what we were talking about here with Shani Currie Mitchell, she had worked in Atlanta before coming here to Western New York. And she says that she had had cases in Atlanta where the evidence just did not hold up. And she says she went to her superiors and she was given the green light to dismiss. Not to plea down or not to pursue, but to dismiss. And she says it was the right thing to do. So I asked about her 5 years when she worked here as an ADA, working under you, if she felt she was able to do the same thing, to speak up when the evidence indicated there should not be prosecution. Here's what she said about that.
I have had experiences where I've felt uncomfortable with the response that I was given when such situations were brought to my attention, when I had a file, and I was uncomfortable with the manner in which I was instructed to prosecute it. And so I'm going to say no. With my experiences, I can't talk about anyone else's. A straight out dismissal has never happened in the 5 years for me, not one.
Should there have been dismissals?
Yes.
But did you ever go to her directly to say, look, you are the one who sets the policy in the office, and I think that occasionally we're getting it wrong?
That's not how that office works.
What do you mean by that?
I don't want to spend much time on that, but I would just say that I, Shani Currie Mitchell, didn't have that kind of access to Sandra Dorley.
But you're working in the office.
I, Shani Currie Mitchell, did not have that kind of access to Sandra Dorley.
Okay. You want to respond to some of that?
Sure. And you know what? I was listening when she was on the radio show. And after that, I had the opportunity to pull all of her cases, the ones that she did in local courts, because she was in misdemeanor courts for quite some time. And when she moved to felony, she was prosecuting, you know, nonviolent car cases. And I looked and, you know, quite contrary, there were many, many cases that she either dismissed outright or no-billed, which means presented it to a grand jury for a finding that there was not reasonable cause to believe a crime had been committed. So she did get rid of or, you know, dismiss many, many cases when she was in the office.
So the record you're saying that you have dug into does not reflect accurately on her remarks on this program?
That's correct.
Okay. Are you aware of why she would make that allegation?
I don't know. I know there was one case in particular that Ms. Mitchell disagreed with her supervisor as to what should be charged. It was a stolen property case and a burglary case. And she and her supervisor both agreed that the top count should have been a burglary in the third degree. But then they had a disagreement afterwards whether or not they should charge the stolen car as a grand larceny in the fourth degree or as an unauthorized use of a motor vehicle in a third degree, which is a misdemeanor. And the two of them had some disagreement, so much so that she and her supervisor went to my first assistant, Perry Duckles. And Ms. Mitchell was able to, you know, argue why she believed her way of indicting the case was proper. Perry Duckles listened to her, listened to Mr. Dice, who was her supervisor, and agreed with Ms. Mitchell. And that was the way that the indictment came out of grand jury. Ultimately, we agreed with her assessment that it should have been a burglary in the third degree and an unauthorized use of a motor vehicle. And that case ultimately went to our judicial diversion part.
So were you surprised to hear her describe her tenure in your office that way then?
I was a little bit. And let me tell you, my office door is always opened. My office is right near the conference room where we hold calendar meetings. I'm there, you know, all the time. Sometimes, you know, I almost want to close the door because I can't get any work done. But people are always coming in. I never, ever, you know, would put up my hand and say, I don't have time for you. I listen to everyone in the office.
How was your relationship with her?
You know what? It was cordial. As again, we didn't have a lot of communication. She was, for the bulk of her time there, she was doing, you know, misdemeanor cases. And then when she was doing car cases, she was doing, you know, a worthy job. She, you know, kept to herself and did her work, which is commendable.
Okay. We're talking to Sandra Dorley, the Monroe County District Attorney, who is spending the hour with us, talking about her record, her term as DA. The last question on the exchange you just heard, and then we're going to move on to some other subjects, is just the idea of dismissal in general. Do you think too few cases are dismissed?
You know what? I think it's a good balance. You know, we are not a rubber stamp on the police. I hope everyone knows that. So when cases come in and we cannot meet our burden, which is proof beyond a reasonable doubt, or even sometimes we don't believe there's enough to go forward with a felony prosecution, reasonable cause to believe, we many, many, many times, you know, dismiss outright or dismiss, you know, a no bill in a grand jury. Or if we have evidence that comes to light after an indictment, we will walk in a courtroom and say, we are going to dismiss this case. You know, I can remember finding out that somebody had an alibi after the fact. We have investigators in the office. We have about 13 of them who are ex, you know, police officers. And, you know, they go out and they supplement every investigation that they can. And when we can prove a defendant's alibi, we will dismiss the case.
Yeah, the portrait painted by critics, and I'm not talking here in Monroe County, across the country of the modern prosecutorial right. system, is of a system in which it's hell-bent on winning one way or another. You obviously don't see it that way.
I don't. You know what? Winning is when justice is served. And justice can be so many things. It's not, like I said, it's not putting someone in jail. Justice sometimes can be, you know, giving a helping hand to an addict and getting them into treatment. Justice can be, you know, taking a young person and throwing, putting them into a program called teen court. Justice can be, you know, sending a veteran to veterans court, things like that. Justice isn't always, you know, the direct pipeline to jail.
All right, so we're going to return to that subject of what to do regarding drug addiction, which is a big issue in this
yes.
county. We're going to get back to that in a second. Let me grab our first phone call. It's Andrew in Rochester. Go ahead, Andrew.
Hi, District Attorney Dorley. I had one question for
sure.
you. What would you say your proudest moment in your time in the DA's office was?
Wow, Andrew, I have, you know, many proud moments. I'm proud of everything the office does, but my personally, my most most important trial that I ever prosecuted was against Thomas Johnson III, who was the individual who shot and murdered Officer Darrell Pearson. And being involved in that case and being involved with law enforcement and just seeing the way law enforcement, you know, they held their, it was one of their very own who was murdered right in front of them, but they investigated with integrity. They never once, wanted revenge. They just wanted, you know, justice for Officer Pearson, and they did a phenomenal job. And to be a part of that and to be able to get the right verdict was really something that I'll never forget in my entire life.
Are there two or three other cases that stand out in your tenure, especially since your elevation to district attorney?
Yeah. You know, when I was first assistant and actually even going into DA, I prosecuted many, many homicide cases that were based on cold cases, on DNA hits, that we would look, you know, back on a case that happened maybe 10 or 15 years before, sometimes even 20 years. And we were able to then identify a potential suspect and then go forward with the trial based on a DNA hit. And one of the grandest moments, I think, in my career, again, was being able to reach out to that family who hadn't had, you know, word from law enforcement for years. And we would be able to say, you know what? We think, you know, we're pretty sure that we have the person who killed your loved one, and we're going to make sure that justice is served.
Talking to District Attorney Sandra Dorley, running for re-election, and certainly your office is one prong in the battle against opioids in this county.
Exactly.
And in Western New York. But how big of a role? I mean, what do you see as the main sort of fuel for this problem? Because, I mean, by the time you're getting involved, you know, certain things have already happened. I'm wondering how you see sort of the structural issues that have led to this and what you think your office's role is.
Yeah. You know, it came to light, really. It was the summer of 2017 when, you know, we started to see all of, you know, individuals in our community dying of an overdose. And we were collecting data, but we weren't collecting data in a uniform way. So I reached out to other DA's offices, and I learned that a lot of them were doing data collection for their crime analysis centers through the use of a form, a very simple form that law enforcement would use when they would go to the scene of an opioid, whether it be fatal or non-fatal. And we would start collecting data so that we could see trends, we could gather real-time information, and then go after the dealers. You know, the goal would be to get, you know, the individual's phone who overdosed and, you know, see if we can identify who their dealers are, and then we could isolate and go after them for, you know, doing long-term investigations or, you know, undercover sales and really try to eliminate the drug dealers in Monroe County. So we started using this form earnestly in 2017, but 2018 in January, when Todd Baxter became sheriff, it was all hands on deck with him, and we partnered with all of our partners in law enforcement. Everyone went online using this form. We created the Monroe County Heroin Task Force. Not only were we collecting data, we were looking at what are we doing with this. We were saying, you know what, prosecution is great, but we also have to look at prevention, we have to look at education, and we've got to stop the problem at the root. So part of the heroin task force, part of the issue was to get to those who have overdosed and survived and make sure that we could get them into treatment. So, you know, I think that's very important. We're doing it today. We're even going out to schools, and I know the sheriff is a big advocate of this. We're going out to schools, middle schools and high schools, and we're talking about, you know, what we're seeing in the community. Dr. Mendoza from the county accompanies us also because the county has taken a lead role. And we want to educate people. We don't want any new individuals coming into our community who are suffering from this addiction. We want to break the addiction, you know, at the very beginning.
Yeah, I remember in my early reporting days in West Virginia talking to the head of corrections in that state. He wasn't talking about heroin, but other drug addiction issues. And he said, if someone gets out of prison after serving a sentence and is the first thing they want is that drug again,
yeah,
then we haven't done a whole lot of good.
Exactly. And you know what the sheriff has done? He is able to give medication-assisted treatment in the jail. So when an inmate is being released out into the community, they're able to stabilize them on some kind of treatment and hand them over to either an outpatient or an inpatient program.
You find that controversial at all?
I don't. You know, there's some, we need to help people in our community. And addiction is a diagnosis. It's something when people are struggling, they can't get out. Sometimes they don't know how to get out. And I think we as citizens need to be able to help them.
The sheriff has been blunt about his desire to see people who deal and sell opioids treated as harshly as possible under the law. Is that happening?
It is. And you know what? I've drawn the line. You know, those of you who are dealing, you know, poison, I call it poison, in our community, I have no sympathy. We're going to prosecute to the fullest extent. But those of you who are suffering, truly suffering from addiction, and I think everyone who's listening knows someone who's suffering from addiction, you know, we want to give them help. We want to give them the upper hand, the warm handover to treatment.
Sure.
And they have to understand that it's a lifelong battle, and we want to be able to start that journey for them.
How significant is this issue compared to all the challenges faced in this community in your 27 years in the office?
You know, it's pretty significant. If you think in 2018, we had 1,133 overdoses, 166 of them being fatal. And again, those are only law enforcement numbers. If we had 166 individuals die in our community of gunfire or some type of violence, the community would be in an uproar.
Well, one of your colleagues, you mentioned the sheriff, he campaigned on kind of taking a broader, more holistic but firm approach on this. And not long after his elevation to that office, said that he did want to see a kind of a drug czar for the county. There isn't one, but is he the de facto person in that role, or is it something else?
You know, I think there are a lot of players in that. I know that, you know, Dr. Mendoza, the county health director, has taken a role, you know, tying in not only public safety, but the medical community, and we needed that tie-in. But I know the sheriff and myself, we have formed very tight relationships with treatment providers in the community, and I consider them now our partners.
Okay, and on the last question on that subject before I grab another phone call is, you know, I know there are so many roots to this. There's not just one cause, but what's the easiest way to answer the question, we will not really turn around the opioid epidemic until what?
Until we educate and work with prevention issues. We're not going to see a difference until our kids in middle school and our high school know that, you know, drugs are deadly, drugs can kill, and drugs can lead to many, many problems.
Okay, let me grab a phone call. This is Robert in Fairport next. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Hey, the Craig Rideout murder case was a very high-profile case for the district attorney's office, and they failed to hang a single charge on Paul Tucci, even though Mr. Tucci was photographed by several hundred cameras at the Macedon Walmart, purchasing the supplies that were later used in the murder. And blood was actually found on his clothing. So I'm astounded that the district attorney's office was not able to convict Mr. Tucci of being associated with this murder, and I'd like to hear the comments from the district attorney on this.
Okay.
I agree with you. I agree with you 100%. But Mr. Tucci was tried in front of a jury of his peers, and that jury found him not guilty based on the evidence. I know that Tim Prosperi, who was the second assistant and lead trial attorney for that trial, put all of the evidence in that we had. He made the best arguments, so much so that several were convicted, but Mr. Tucci was acquitted. I agree, but it's our jury system. And even though I'm disappointed in that verdict, I respect our jury system. It's really the best system that we have in our country. It doesn't always come down in our favor. I don't know what the jurors were looking for, but I can tell you, I have to respect the verdict. But I agree with you. If I was on that jury, I probably would have found otherwise.
How do you feel like your office's record stacks up on cases, the quote-unquote high-profile cases like this, in terms of getting the results that you think that you ought to get?
You know what? I think we've done a great job. We were very disappointed in the Rideout case, and obviously we were very disappointed in two of the Boys and Girls Club trials that we were not able to get convictions. But again, I know that we put our best foot forward. I know that we put forward all of the available evidence that we had that the court allowed us to get into, and we did our best. And sometimes we could only do, you know, what we can do with the evidence that we have. We certainly, you know, aren't going to be fabricating evidence. We're really confined to what the evidence is, what in terms of what we can present to a jury.
I know Robert was going to mention a case. We were talking opioids. I thought he might mention the one that's been in the news this week on the Rochester Drug Cooperative.
Yes.
I don't know how much you're able to talk about that. Can you?
You know, I don't know much about it other than what I've read in the paper. That's a federal prosecution.
Sure.
But it's certainly going to be interesting.
To see national news come out of here.
Exactly. But I can see where the U.S. Attorney's Office is going. It's something similar to what I've been doing with the prosecution of those who provide a deadly narcotic to an individual resulting in their death. The law isn't straightforward, but if you can prove that the individual knew or had some kind of knowledge to establish that what they were doing was going to cause death or serious physical injury to another person, if you could prove that, then that's what we've been doing. So I look forward to seeing how my federal counterparts are going to be proving it.
All right, let's get our only break of the hour. And when we come back, we'll explore many of the other issues in this race for District Attorney of Monroe County. The two-time incumbent is here, Sandra Dorley, Monroe County District Attorney since her election in 2011. And she is running for re-election. So let's get that break. If you want to call the program, you can do that. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. Coming up in our second hour, we shift gears in a big way. The whole world is getting ready for the new Avengers movie. Well, not the whole world. Some of us haven't seen all of the Marvel films, but a lot of people have. And even if you have not, we're going to have some fun next hour. We're going to talk about, well, understanding, getting inside the head of the big baddie Thanos, and why our panel is so excited about this blockbuster that comes out tonight. That's next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. To be fair, you're the district attorney and been there for 8 years now, I don't know if you have, I'm sure you have a campaign website. I always have to ask our candidates if they want to tell our listeners. Are you online?
I am now. It's sandradorley.com.
Okay.
Yes.
Sorry about that. Should have asked you off the top. SandraDorley.com, Monroe County District Attorney who's running for re-election. Now, there is a lot of talk about, let's get to another drug that a lot of people are talking about, which is cannabis, and there's a lot of talk about legalization there. And your opponent in the race said that if she were the district attorney, she would decline to prosecute for marijuana possession. How do you feel about that?
Well, right now it's still the law, so individuals come before the court charged with usually low-level unauthorized possession of marijuana or unlawful possession of marijuana, UPM as we call it, and other types of criminal possession of marijuana, misdemeanor levels. And before I came here, I wanted to check and tell you and tell the public unequivocally, when those individuals come into court, whether they be town courts or city court, what we do as a rule of thumb is adjourn it in contemplation of dismissal, which means it's a dismissal in 6 months. And that's generally what we do. Now, if you think about, if we ever said, you know what, we're going to take a hard stance on marijuana and we're going to prosecute every case that comes through the door, even you know, the low-level violation possessions, we would have to get that marijuana tested by the lab. And I know you know from personal experience, how busy our Monroe Crime Lab is. You know, I think we would be laughed out of the lab if we went over and had them test every single joint. So, you know, we're not going forward. You know, I realize that, you know, many, many people use it recreationally. We respect that. I respect the fact that it does, it's used by, you know, people, you know, in the city, people of color sometimes. They're coming into court. So we ACD all of them.
And that means dismissal in 6 months?
In 6 months.
And what happens in that intervening 6 months with their record, with everything that's going on?
So it doesn't get sealed until 6 months, but it gets sealed in 6 months when they come back to court.
Okay.
After it gets automatically sealed, I'm sorry, they don't have to come back to court.
Is the takeaway from this then that what you're trying to kind of elucidate is we really don't see a whole lot of low-level offenses prosecuted with marijuana?
We don't. And we don't see a lot of offenses being arrested in the community. I don't know if you saw the article that the DNC did a couple of days ago where they actually did a chart of all of the 62 counties in New York State, and they ranked them in terms of how many arrests or for marijuana possession are made in each county. And if you look at in terms of one being, you know, the most arrests to 62 being the least amount of arrests, we come in at 54 in New York, in Monroe County. We have, I'm putting on my glasses, it's 3.84% of the total arrests are for marijuana possession. So it's really a small portion, you know, of arrests that we see come in our door.
Okay. Do you want to see legalization happen for recreational?
You know what? I would like to see decriminalization over legalization. I think there are a lot of issues with legalization. I've spoken to counterparts in Colorado. I do believe that legalization is coming. That train has left the station. But I say to all of those in our legislature who are going to be drafting the legislation, if you're going to do it smart. Do it to protect public safety. Do it to protect our community. I don't think we're ever going to see a decline of a black market of marijuana. I think even if we do see it legal and we do have the dispensaries, I think we're still going to see a black market for it, because I think people are going to be looking to purchase it perhaps without paying a tax to the government, or perhaps to buy it, you know, cheaper.
Okay. And when it comes to the work that you've done in DWI, in vehicular cases, which you have extensive experience
exactly.
with, we had some police chiefs on this program not too long ago. We had Sheriff Tom Doherty from Livingston County. We had Chief Patrick Phelan from Greece. And they were expressing concern that if legalization happens, what are they going to do for a field test to understand impairment? Do you worry about that?
Exactly, exactly. You know, with a driving while impaired with alcohol, you just take the Alka-Seltzer or a breath test, and you can determine, you know, the percentage of blood alcohol in a person's system. It's very difficult to do it for marijuana or any type of illegal drug or narcotic unless you have an actual blood test. And again, you know, maybe some people may consent to a blood test. If not, you've got to get, you know, a court order. Then you're going to a lab. And, you know, waiting maybe 6 weeks to get a result, it's going to be, you know, very difficult to prove those types of cases. And what we see very huge amounts of DWI and driving while ability impaired by drugs as it is now. But what we see is more of a cocktail of what people are using. So those who are pulled over, you know, for a vehicle and traffic offense or for accidents or a fatality, we find that they have a cocktail in their system of alcohol, pills, and some type of drug.
Hmm. Now, one other question on that before we get back to our all of a sudden mini phone calls, which is on the subject of, you know, kind of staying on that thread, because what the district attorney is saying is a lot of the idea that low-level offenses are going to get arrested and prosecuted does not get borne out by the facts, I think is what the district attorney is saying. So I want to ask you about if you think there's any disparity. And I know you've heard what critics say. Just 5 minutes before this program, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez tweeted the following, quote, "Black Americans and people of color are far more likely to be convicted and sentenced longer than white Americans for similar crimes. Our system routinely criminalizes poverty and exonerates wealth." Those two statements. Let's start with the first one. Black Americans and people of color are far more likely to be convicted and sentenced longer than white Americans for similar crimes. Yes or no?
Yes. Yes, I do believe that. But I'd like to say that when everyone in my office, including myself, when we look at a case, we look at the facts, we look at evidence, and we base our judgment on how to proceed based upon the facts and evidence. I know I never look at a person's race when I'm determining what is fair and what is just. I do believe it happens, and I think we all have to be conscious of that. But again, we're not making the arrests. The arrests come to us. You know, our office maybe, you know, originates maybe 1% of all the cases that we prosecute. So we're getting cases in from the law enforcement agencies throughout the county, and then it's our determination as to how to go forward with that. And again, we base what we do on the facts and on the evidence, sometimes on a person's prior conviction record, because that would affect what type of sentencing they would be eligible for. But that's what it should be. It shouldn't ever be based on the color of a person's skin.
And you're confident that your office kind of follows that ethos?
I'm confident, and if any of you are listening to me now, take this as a reminder. And in fact, we are having implicit bias training in the next couple of months. Michelle Crowley, who is my director of attorney training, is putting together, you know, various panels, bringing in people from the community to talk about implicit bias and just to re-educate everyone, because I think every once in a while, everyone needs to know, you know, what we do not only affects a victim, a defendant, a defendant's family, a victim's family, it affects a community. And we really want to be the establishment that is affecting justice equally and even-handedly in the community.
Okay. And then so if we do have a system where, at least currently, and we're talking generally, not necessarily here, if Black Americans and people of color are more likely to be convicted and sentenced longer than white Americans for similar crimes, is that out of malice or out of probably implicit bias where people in the system don't realize that they are enforcing laws differently?
Yeah, I would say out of implicit bias and just not understanding. And that's why there always needs to be continuing education in that area.
And when the congresswoman says our system routinely criminalizes poverty and exonerates wealth, yes or no?
No. Not in Monroe County. We prosecute people who are, you know, below the poverty level, yes. But you know what? We also prosecute people who, you know, make millions of dollars. We don't discriminate.
Okay. Back to your phone calls. And let's go ahead and get Rich in Rochester next. Go ahead, Rich.
To just follow up on the marijuana arrest. I know you don't have total control of this, but do you frown upon the practices that some police use? Like the example of if a person removes marijuana out of their pocket and hands it to police, it becomes a misdemeanor, as if in case of if the cop frisks them and finds it, becomes an infraction. How do you stop those type of things where we don't have these manufactured misdemeanors coming to the courts, and I don't know why the police do it, whatever their reasoning is?
Yeah.
Do you frown upon those kind of practices, and what do you do to work with the police department to stop those kind of things?
Right. And you know what? We do look at, you know, profiling cases, and again, those are the cases that we would probably be dismissing outright. We do educate police officers on that practice. Oftentimes, if we see a case where we believe, you know, maybe the person was profiled and stopped for that reason, not for any other reasonable suspicion, probable cause, or any of the other reasons why police can stop, you know, we'll have a conversation with the officer and dismiss the case and move forward. We train police officers to make sure that that doesn't occur. But with respect to marijuana, if you did hear what I had said about where we fall in terms of arrests for marijuana possession in the state, we are 54th out of 62 counties. So it means that police are not arresting a lot of people in Monroe County for possession of marijuana.
Dan in Brighton wants to know, if marijuana becomes legal in some way, would you forgive past charges for people who have possessed it?
Absolutely. And I believe I've said that before. I believe it was to Channel 10. Absolutely. If that's the only thing on their record and it would be a barrier to housing or to education or to anything like that, I would absolutely do it.
Okay. Let me get back to your phone calls. Lori in Pittsford is next. Go ahead, Lori.
Hi, I'm calling about a very cold case. It was the Crow's Neck Axe murder, which occurred back in 82 in Brighton.
Yes.
And it was my understanding that your office reopened that case, and I was wondering whatever happened.
It is still a pending case in the office, and it's still one that we are looking at, and hopefully we will have a resolution as to whether or not we're going forward or closing it very shortly. But thank you for asking about that case. That was a horrible, horrible situation that happened back in 1982.
A little girl left in the house all day, and it was very gruesome.
Exactly. And I've been working with the Brighton Police Department on that, and they're doing a fantastic job. Now we have to look at, you know, what we have to see if it's enough to go forward. Because you have to remember, even though we may think we know who did it, we need evidence that we're able to present in court to establish proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
John in Rochester is next. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Hey, Sandra. Sandra, I get outraged by some of these murderers that don't get the death penalty. Richard Matt, remember Richard Matt, who escaped from that prison in the eastern part of New York, along with David Sweat, I think his name was.
Oh, Dan Amore, up in Clinton County. Yeah.
Right. I actually know the son of Matt's murder victim, who he tortured and cut up in pieces. And this guy should have got the death penalty. And that lowlife Thomas Johnson, the third, he should have got the death penalty. If, in fact, I guess it's a moot point right now in New York State about the death penalty, if it wasn't a moot point that they could prosecute using the death penalty, would you do it?
Well, you know what it is? I follow the law, unfortunately. I don't believe in the death penalty, but I follow the law in New York State. It is unconstitutional for a death penalty. I do believe in life without the possibility of parole for those convicted of murder in the first degree. But, you know, I have seen, you know, people be convicted of crimes, and years later, upon appellate review, something may come up where the conviction is overturned. So knowing how the system works, I think I do oppose the death penalty, but I don't oppose life without the possibility of parole.
Are you concerned that we see too many false confessions?
No, I'm not. I'm very confident now with the institution of videotaping confessions. I think that has brought a new level to how we evaluate a confession. You know, before, when we were seeing an influx of wrongful confessions, you saw alleged statements of defendants on a piece of paper, and you never saw, you know, how that came out, how the conversation was between the defendant and the investigator. And I think now we're seeing, you know, fewer and fewer false confessions. Of course, if it's in someone's mind that they want to confess for that, there's no way that we can really get into that person's mind unless, you know, what they're telling us does not meet the facts of the case.
Sure. I'm more thinking of what a lot of the critics point to, which is the idea that an investigator can lie and say, we have your fingerprint, we have your whatever, we have a piece of your clothing from the scene, we know you were there, when you don't. Should you be allowed to lie like that? I don't say you.
I know.
Investigators.
Exactly. But you know what? That is the law. They can do that. You know,
Are you comfortable with that?
You know, I like honesty, but I want a solid confession. I want a case that's going to be upheld on appellate review. Is it a investigative technique that is used? Yes. Do the investigators here in this county, namely, you know, Monroe County, sheriffs and RPD, use that all the time? No, I see it less and less as we're going forward. So that's a good thing. And again, with the advent of videotape recordings, we're able to see from soup to nuts what goes on.
I have two different emails from listeners who said they would like to vote for you, but as Democrats, they were upset that you switched parties 4 years ago, and they have not gotten over that. So it comes up occasionally.
It does.
You want to address that?
It does. And you know what? I was a Republican before I switched to Democrat to run that year. That was the year in 2011 that I really wanted to run for district attorney. And as many of you remember, that was the year that Mike Green was also given the nod to ascend to the federal court bench. And the Democrats at that point had the hopes that Judge Frank Geraci would run for DA. The Republicans had already given the nomination to Bill Taylor. And there I was, a first assistant. I was a career prosecutor. I really wanted to be DA. And the opportunity came when Frank Geraci decided not to run. There was an opening for DA, and it was a last-minute call. I had already started a campaign for county court, and the Democrats reached out to me, and I took the opportunity. I don't think a DA should be a party, actually, because you know what? We've got to even-handedly administer justice.
Does your party affiliation matter in your day-to-day work?
It does not. It does not. And I run a nonpartisan office, and I don't even know the political affiliation of any of the people that I work with, really.
Or who work for you.
Who work for me. Thank you.
Sam in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Sam.
I still don't think that she told you the truth when you asked her about her party affiliation, because if that was true, why didn't you tell the people before they voted for you that you were going to be changing from Democrat to Republican? But that's not what I really want to talk about. What I really want to talk about is a guy named Jane Byrd in Texas, and three guys, and they just executed the last guy on yesterday. They tied him, he was walking home. They tied him, three white guys, and they was a member of the KKK, white supremacists. They tied him with chains behind a truck and drug him till his body disintegrated. And they walked back 3 miles, drove back 3 miles, and they found body parts all up and down the road. They found his head, they found his arm, found his feet, found his intestines. And he did nothing to them. All he was doing was walking home. They were drunk, and they wanted to have fun with a black guy. And the last guy, there was three guys, three white guys, and they were honored. They were honored by the KKK, and they were honored by the Ku Klux Klan for doing that to the black guy.
I want to understand what you're asking, though, Sam. Go ahead.
Well, I'm just saying that I don't think the case got enough publicity, and it should have gotten more publicity than it did, because half of the people who are hearing this now for the first time don't even know that exists out in Texas, that they did that. And there are other things that happened out in Texas where there was some kids, and the only thing they gave the kids was probation. But what they did was they found a black guy who was mentally impaired. They wanted to have some fun with him, and they burned him half to death, and he died from what happened to him. And you know what happened to the kids? They gave him probation.
So, Sam, I got to jump in and just say, I mean, it's a horrific story that you're telling, and you're right. I think people probably should know that. It did not happen here. I'm not trying to downplay it in any way. I just want to make sure that we stay in our last few minutes with the district attorney on local matters. So, but Sam, I appreciate you kind of bringing that up and making sure people are aware of that story. District Attorney Dorley, there's been a lot of talk about police accountability. Do you support any of the proposals in this community that you've seen?
I don't support the Police Accountability Board. I think that the Rochester Police Department has a very functional and very effective internal affairs, and I've seen it at work. And I think it really does protect the community.
Okay. Do you think with the way sort of status quo, even though there can be a review of police actions, historically the chief has had discretion to say yes or no to recommendations of discipline. Are you comfortable with that?
So far I have been, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so you don't see yourself supporting any of the proposals going forward?
Exactly.
Said. Okay. In this community, are you confident that if police do wrong, that they will not be treated differently, separately, or given a pass?
Look at my record. I mean, I hate to say this, but I have been one prosecutor in this county who has, over her career, prosecuted police officers, and this office continues to, you know, prosecute those who violate the law, whether they are in uniform or whether they are anyone from the inner city or from our suburbs.
And Gray wants to know, several law enforcement agencies and sheriffs have come out against the governor's proposal to issue driver's licenses for illegal immigrants. What is her opinion? Do you find it relevant in this case?
I don't find it relevant at all.
Okay. So it's not something that you want to weigh in or have thought much about?
I haven't really thought much about it at this point.
Okay. In our last about 90 seconds or so, you know, you've decided you're going to run for a third term here, and you've been serving for 27 years in this county. What is your driving motivation for three terms? What kind of gets you up and gets you fired up?
Because I love what I do. I love the office. I love what we do for the community. I love that we can bring justice to crime victims. We can make sure that, you know, we treat defendants fairly, and I think we will continue to do that. We have a lot of new programs that we're coming up with. We didn't get to really talk about diversion courts, but one of them that I'm really proud of and I would love to spend time talking about is our gun crimes part, which is something that we, you know, after 2015, we no longer send individuals who are caught with an illegal firearm directly to state prison. We offer diversion programs, and we are seeing a reduction of violence in our community. We are now establishing a conviction integrity unit. I've been speaking with people in the community. I want it to be made up of community members, prosecutors, retired law enforcement, and that's going to be rolled out very shortly. We have another program that we're coming up with, and I can't wait to see it happen, is a mental health diversion. So, you know, so many of our people that we see in the criminal justice system have a mental health issue, and instead of warehousing them in the jail, when an arrest is made for certain misdemeanors or low-level felonies, we're going to divert them to treatment instead of bringing them into the court system.
All right, so those are just some of the things
so
you're working on?
Lots of things. I know. I could probably talk for another 10 minutes
well,
on that.
I do hope that we can talk to you again as we go throughout the year here, talk about not only these plans and the work that you're doing in this community, both because you're running an active campaign, but also because you're the district attorney. And we always appreciate the conversation and your time. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much.
And it's sandradorley.com is the website if you want to take a look more about the record and plans and ideas from District Attorney Sandra Dorley in Monroe County. You have heard from now the Democrat challenging the district attorney and the district attorney yourself, and we hope to bring you a lot more in the ways of this race as we go throughout the campaign season. Short break, more connections coming up.